Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to the Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak to Reason's senior editors, Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangu Ward, and Matt Welch, to get their thoughts on news of the day. Hello, everyone.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello. Hello.
Howdy ho.
We're going to cover a lot of ground today. We've got the Afghanistan War's next chapter, Steve Bannon exiting the White House and entering a pupa hibernation state at Breitbart, President Trump facing off with Arizona Republicans, and the ongoing political fallout from Charlottesville. And just so you know, at home, Catherine and I are recording from the same room today like regular human beings.
I'm against it.
And Matt, you're back from Gaul. You were in France for 2 weeks. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It was actually in a trilateral triangle. That sounds nastier than it is, between Switzerland, France, and Germany there along the Rhine River. And it was very entertaining to sit there and listen to all the American discussion about blood and soil while hanging out in the Rhineland with people who become wealthy by rejecting such talk.
Are you sort of the unofficial Trump-splainer when you're over there, Matt?
You know what? It's not as bad since Europe is going through its own problems with Le Pen's and whatnot there. But there was a moment at my wife's brother's house, and he's got like a three-day-old kid there. And he's like, who's going to replace Mooch?
Mooch.
The world is paying attention.
Even to the Mooch. Great. Well, later tonight, President Trump is going to address the nation on the war in Afghanistan, which is now old enough to drive a car. And he will likely increase troops there and has asked the nation to trust his judgment. Nick, what do you think is going to happen to the presidential address?
Well, I think it's a real shame that the Afghanistan war can fight in Afghanistan, but it can't legally have a drink. That's my biggest problem with it right now. I have no idea. To be quite honest, this is a real test case of Bannon leaving, because one of the backstories there is just whether or not Bannon was any kind of non-interventionist, unless it was directly in American national interest, versus a kind of deep state cadre of advisors who are going to be, now we have to stay in Afghanistan forever because we're the indispensable nation, which means that we should have a never-ending stream of young men and women who can die for no clear, discernible goal. My summary of Afghanistan is simply, I mean, you know, at what point are we going to actually come up with a mission that is both articulated in clear terms to the American people and possibly able to be finished? I'm thinking if we don't have it now, we're not going to have it after Trump's speech tonight.
Do you think there is an actual conclusive, this is what we came in, and if we haven't accomplished it, cut our losses, or this is what victory looks like? Is there something that we can sink our teeth into?
Rhetorically, at the very least, I think Trump will give us, this is what victory looks like, and we're about to accomplish it, or this is what victory looks like, and we're going to be
through a one-time small increase of troops.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, I don't think that there is a goal there other than, you know, I mean, one of the ways to think about it, and I'm not sure what Matt or Catherine think about this, but is that the Afghanistan war was ultimately more about keeping Pakistan in check. Pakistan is a nuclear power. Pakistan, you know, is a large country and is a hotbed of terrorism. So it may be that the main reason we're sticking in Afghanistan, which could never be articulated because Pakistan is also our good allies, is just to be closer to Pakistan.
Catherine, during the campaign, I tried to figure out what Trump's foreign policy was, and it seemed to oscillate rapidly between this very muscular kind of Reagan-esque, carry a big stick, I guess that's Roosevelt, nonetheless, this sort of muscular Republican platform, and then he would also be a hardcore non-interventionist. Is there such a thing as a Trump foreign policy?
I don't think so, and I think we saw a bunch of libertarian types who were briefly hopeful that Trump was going to be a non-interventionist if they were relying on Bannon to bring that side out of him. I guess that act in this drama is over. But no, I think Trump is, in this as in all things, extremely reactive. And, you know, I don't think in this case we were doing any kind of wagging of the dog, but it is like, hey, let's stop talking about Nazis and start talking about war, America. And America's like, fine, great. Yeah, let's just do that. That seems better than the Nazi thing.
Are you implying that there could be a Trump policy or press conference that's designed to distract people rather than deal with the pertinent issue at the time?
I would never imply such a thing. Certainly not, you crazy man. Now, I mean, this is something that's clearly been in the works. This is not, unlike so many of Trump's other major national security announcements, this actually seems to be something that he's talked over with the relevant humans. So that should be refreshing. But I absolutely agree. There is no way that we're going to walk out of this with like, okay, great. So what we want to do is like stabilize the security situation to X, Y, and Z specific parameters with the use of a very concrete number of troops, which we will not exceed, and then be out in 18 months. That's not going to be where we are at the end of this address.
It's a damn shame, too, because Trump has made noises, particularly about Afghanistan, in interviews and in comments this year. Saying, hey, we've been there for 17 years. I want to figure out why. Like, what's the point? That's actually the right question as far as I'm concerned. And it's disappointing to see that the answer for him is this kind of, you know, qualified 4,000 troop increase, which is immediately greeted by Bill Kristol as, it's a good start. But, we'll
just keep doing it. Who doesn't like a surge? Everybody likes a surge.
Matt, have you been happy so far with Trump's foreign policy? I ask this because Catherine brought up that a lot of libertarians, coming from a non-interventionist perspective, were kind of enthused about Trump, or at least enthused about the foreign policy angle he had during the campaign. And I've been looking at him as a reflexive authoritarian without any ideological moorings. I sort of thought that we were going to be fighting more than we have so far. I don't know that that won't happen in the future, but he's been about as restrained as I could have hoped for.
Can I just jump in and say, I don't think a lot of libertarians were hopeful about Trump. I think a small group of people who put, it was the triumph of hope over experience, maybe said some words that sounded positive. Hopefully no one on this podcast.
No, I think that's accurate. And to clarify, like, I was not a Trump fan, but was at least hopeful of his foreign policy within the debates. But yeah, I don't think I was in the Trump camp. Matt, what do you think? Has he been restrained?
No, I mean, he's been comparatively restrained in that he hasn't started any new wars, but he's only been around for 7 months here. And this Afghanistan thing is a bad indicator of what can happen. Think about his tweet of last week talking about, you know, we got to do what General Pershing did, study history. He got rid of terrorism in the Philippines for 35 years. He's variously said it's 42, 28, 15, depends on the story. But the story that he was referring to, it's interesting. Which is a lie, nakedly, like no one says this happened, of General Blackjack Pershing allegedly like shooting 49 out of 50 villagers in bullets dipped in pig's blood and sending the 50th back to the villagers and saying, all right, here you go, Muslim. Go tell everyone else to not cross us. This never happened. It's ridiculous. But he told that story in February 2016. That is an interesting time. He told that story in South Carolina when the other thing that he was saying was that the Bush family totally screwed up American foreign policy because they were interventionists, they were neocons, and they were nation builders, which kind of true. So I think Ted Cruz, who tried to sell his more restrained type of foreign policy with like, let's just turn everything into, you know, glass. That's what Trump is doing. He tried to make it this sort of Jacksonian guff there. But that gets you to the point of you got to make a decision now about direction. And so he had this chance right now to make that decision. And the decision was we're going to go with the terrible, I think, centrist status quo. Let's keep in mind that twice as many or nearly twice as many U.S. soldiers died in Afghanistan under Barack Obama than under George W. Bush. What the hell is that? That doesn't even make any sense. And yet that's kind of the universe that we're in. So this is really significant. He could have taken an opportunity to go in a certain direction, and he didn't. And he's surrounded by military people who will say similar things. And I think that's sad.
I'm interested to see what happens when he gets out of this mode that he's still in, despite being president, where he does this kind of like, just asking questions. Like, I'm just asking, what are we even doing there? And it's like, you're literally the commander in chief now. You tell us.
Matt, a moment ago, you mentioned the Jacksonian guff, and I, in looking at Trump's quasi-foreign policy, it does seem to me that rhetoric is a part of it, that he seems to be factoring in trying to bluff and trying to use public relations to maybe counteract North Korea. I'm not saying it's a good idea, but it appears to be part of what he's doing. Is rhetorical flourish an actual element of foreign policy, and is he using it well?
Sure, it is an element. I wouldn't say that he's using it well. He is deliberately, vis-a-vis North Korea, using what his people call strategic unpredictability, like trying to make everyone think that he's the crazy one. So that
he's using the hell out of that. He's really doing a great job of deploying strategy.
Nicely done,
except
sir.
For the strategic part. Yeah, he's got it down pat.
Yeah, I mean, and think about it. He was declaring victory like 10 days ago on Twitter because North Korea decided not to nuke Guam. And it's like, you know what? That's not where we were in January. Exactly. So, no, I don't think that that's very helpful. But it's interesting to look at his rhetoric and his changes of emphases. When he was in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, he's like, we're not going to run your business. We're not going to tell you what's going on. But when he talks about Venezuela, when he talks about Cuba, when he talks about our hemisphere, he has a real sense of this is in our strategic interest. So we're going to play an outsized role, kind of old Monroe Doctrine type of view out there. So the mix of all of that, I think, is pretty unsettled right now.
I do think it's worth thinking about this in terms of deep state issues, because, you know, as Matt pointed out, the status quo is intervention, or rather the projection of American force through, you know, uncountable, you know, numbers of bases all over the world and troops strung out all over the world. And what we have seen over the, you know, the course of Trump's presidency so far is a reassertion of that after Trump brought in a couple of people, including, you know, people like Mike Flynn, who were a challenge to that. And whether or not they were good people or not, I mean, you know, it's worth pointing out that where we are now is a kind of foreign policy establishment asserting itself in the White House that is indistinguishable from what came before it, both under Obama and under George W. Bush.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Like, all of our foreign policy tends to be realism in the academic sense, which is to say that it's based on us trying to keep our hegemony and other countries potentially trying to react by asserting their own increase in military. And it doesn't change tremendously from administration to administration, nor with people working in the Department of State. Henry Kissinger is mentored or indirectly mentored virtually everybody that's been a top person in the State Department, I guess until Tillerson, who does represent an outside force.
I like the part in the podcast that we have now where Andrew Heaton defines a basic academic term in each podcast. I guess today is Realism Day. Today's podcast is brought to you by the World Realism.
Yeah, realism. It's the idea that countries operate like billiard balls. I've got maybe three more academic terms over the course of the next year, so I'll
eventually
run
through
them.
That's your full knowledge.
Then I'm through with it, exactly. So when it comes to Trump's lack of realism in foreign policy, when it comes to his intervention, Nick, a minute ago you brought up Steve Bannon, that he was one of the forces of non-interventionism in the White House. He is now gone. President Trump either ousted him or accepted his resignation, depending on how we look at it, last week, and he is returning to Breitbart. Bannon was both the non-interventionist advisor, and he was also simultaneously the most populist, not ethno-nationalist, but I'm sorry, economic nationalist in the White House. And so he's going to somewhat unmoor, I guess, even more so than he already has been, absent Bannon. Does anything actually change now?
Yeah, I think so. But first, I think it's important to point out that Bannon is not an anti-interventionist. He's a or even a non-interventionist. He loves a big, strong military. Very much so. And it's that he wants the military to be used to advance the national interests of the United States, which on a certain level is realism. But in his case, it seemed to be, because you mentioned the populism, you know, he wants to have shows of strength every once in a while, and he wants to project a very kind of bellicose attitude, as he does in his, in his dealings with people and things like that. So I think what changes is that the pros in the military-industrial complex may be more measured in their responses than Bannon or Trump would be absent, but it will be bad. I mean, these guys have been in charge at least since the beginning of the 21st century, and they have not done well. There's very little for us to show in our foreign policy that is, that's working really great, so that we should be staying the course. We don't have a large idea of how to interact factor, how to make America's role in the world a generally productive one and a peaceful one, as opposed to kind of hanging out in various quagmires and getting more and more drawn into places like the Middle East. So I think that's problematic. How Bannon actually engages the Trump White House is a different question. Matt, Matt had a couple of hypotheticals that he wrote about last week, which I think are worth thinking about. And, you know, and it's either that Breitbart is going to castigate Trump as Arnold Schwarzenegger 2.0, which is to say a feckless, unprincipled, losing leader who just becomes a kind of a whipdog who doesn't really advance much of a right-wing agenda, or that Bannon is, you know, I mean, what he said, what he's told people is that he's going to be supporting Trump in all sorts of ways. So we'll have to see on that score.
I'm also not sure what people will make of commentary about the Trump White House, which essentially accuses it of being more or less mainstream, which is what it seems like Bannon is going to do, right? He's going to say, look at these guys, they're business as usual, when all of America is currently absolutely losing its shit about the fact that Donald Trump is so far from business as usual. So I think there's going to be a weird disjunct between the message that's coming out of Breitbart. Presuming that the current dynamic holds, that message will sort of trickle into Fox News in a kind of mediated way. That will be a thing that a good chunk of Americans believe. And so they will be saying, maybe Donald Trump is part of the establishment. He's part of the mainstream, and he's the reason that we're not getting the radical change we need to see, while everyone on the left is going to be saying, oh my God, he's so radical. I can't believe how radical he is. This is the most radical president we've ever had. What does the discussion even look like then? How could we possibly talk to each other?
Wait, so at that point, Trump might simultaneously be the disruptive revolutionary of the left's perspective while also being the hardcore establishmentarian that's unable to shake things up?
Yeah, I think that's where we might end up. And I wonder, I mean, it strikes me that there is like a way of navigating through those waters that actually results in something non-horrific, right? Like it could be like Donald Trump just sort of bumbles around doing basically normal stuff because he can't figure out how to do anything particularly unusual and there's no one to help him.
Well, you know, I think part of keeping that in mind, and the analyses I've read that I find pretty interesting are that Bannon won't criticize and Breitbart won't criticize Trump directly. They'll go after particular people in his cabinet. Remember that Bannon is the guy who, talked a lot and openly about dismantling the administrative state. And to the degree that he is going after kind of regulators or agency heads who are doing business as usual, that might be good. Because, you know, one of the things that's fascinating is, remember how both during your confirmation hearings, and even, you know, a month ago or so, people on the left particularly were fired up about Betsy DeVos. Who knows? I mean, she might have pulled all federal funding for public schools at this point. Nobody has been paying attention to her whatsoever. Same thing with some of the people at EPA and FDA and FCC. To the extent that Trump is engaging in a lot of, bizarre and I find unseemly rhetoric about, you know, moral equations between, Nazis and non-Nazis and things like that, it's also conceivably giving cover to a kind of Bannonite program of dismantling the administrative state.
There's two parts about Bannon that are worth crap. One is that deconstruction of the administrative state. And the other one is just kind of half worth of crap in his approach towards foreign policy being somewhat different and less interventionist than before in a way that challenges, or it did until he left, the status quo. But let's also remember there's one issue that he's probably even more fired up on than either of those, which is trade, and that he's frustrated and he will be aiming his guns at people in the White House who don't get that we really should have trade wars and 35% tariffs at the border and all this nonsense. And shout out to the deep state. One thing that they're good on is that they generally prefer and understand the point of having international exchange, helping countries in a mutual way. So I think, and that's also proven really difficult for Donald Trump to undo. It's kind of tricky, just like Brexit, like the details are kind of difficult once you actually start to sit down and negotiate them. So he will be inveighing against all of that from the outside. And I think that'll be largely a good thing. But I want to raise one quick thing, which is, what we're seeing is this rise of a parallel government and I don't mean that in a conspiratorial way, but to the degree that Donald Trump just says stuff. He says, I don't think, you know, Russia had anything to do with the election or some variation on that. And then his ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, and a bunch of other people who are in senior administration positions will just say, they did, we've concluded, and there's no doubt about that. So this is happening all over the place. It'll happen, I think, I predict, in his trade policies. It'll happen in different places where you have all these people who fundamentally disagree with him, but who are serving him for their own reasons. Maybe it's a sense of patriotism or power or whatever. And they're just going to kind of, there's been increased chatter that they're just sort of, okay, you know, Junior got the Twitter out again, but we're going to go over there. Like the military, when they reacted to the trans ban, was just like, nah, that's not really happening. So anyways, what's going on?
Well, you know, it's also...
That's interesting. That's weird.
Well, it's also, I mean, the trans ban, comes down to basically one tweet that Trump did in clear ignorance of the fact that, among other things, the Pentagon was actually doing a long study on, you know, on trans soldiers and the effects on morale and all of that kind of stuff. So I think you're right. And it'll be kind of curious to see if Trump becomes a figurehead where he gets to talk as much as he wants and he talks off the cuff and everything, but he's really almost totally disconnected from the actual workings of government. And I could see that going in a good direction if it is people dismantling aspects of the administrative state where there are just kind of rules put in without, clear, kind of processes in place to really make sure that they make sense or advance even what they claim to, much less whether or not we should do it. But I'm thinking, Matt and Catherine, both in the ways that you were talking about foreign policy, is that one of the things that we forget all the time, and this is something that Rand Paul on the Republican side and Gary Johnson, as the Libertarian Party candidate, talked about, which is that so focused on equating foreign policy with military actions and military presence that, you know, it's really as much about things like immigration, including things like H-1B visas, as well as unskilled worker visas. And the Republican Party itself is absolutely against immigration now. The bill that has the ear of everybody is something that would cut legal immigration in half. But, you know, there's immigration, there's trade, there's kind of cultural exchange and a sense of openness, as well as military presence. And this is where I think Trump is completely out to sea, and the country is. Like, we don't have a sense of what should America's place in the world be and role in the world be in the 21st century, where, you know, everything is more decentralized, everything is more dispersed, including the ability of any one country to kind of dictate terms around the globe. We're not Rome, and it didn't work out for Rome that well, being the hegemon, to a point where you end up being overextended and in effect almost everything you do. That's the conversation that we need to be having, and I can't see us doing that, you know, anytime before 2020.
Well, certainly not with Trump, I wouldn't think. Like, one of the interesting things that'll come out of this is that Bannon, who I am no great fan of, was willfully disruptive. He seemed to be planning to be disruptive and enjoyed that, whereas I think the president's disruptive just kind of for the hell of it. And the fallout from that in terms of any type of coherent ideology being espoused is going to be extensive. Very quickly, Nick, I'm curious. You brought up foreign policy, and I know you're a non-interventionist. Would you stick around NATO? Would you want to do that?
I think NATO needs to be completely rethought. I mean, it was created to stand up to an enemy that no longer exists, and that doesn't mean that treaties and organizations like that don't have a role. But yeah, it's any corporation that's been around for 50 or 60 or 70 years, kind of changes over time. NATO has changed over time. And it does not make sense. The American presence or a U.S. presence in Europe is really different now than it would have been in the late 40s when the Soviet Union still existed and when fascism was, still in the smell of fascism and the defeat of it was still in everybody's nostrils.
To get back to Bannon, Matt, now that Bannon's gone, do you think there's a possibility for reapproachment between Trump and the establishment? Might there possibly be some sort of lack of gridlock that will happen now that grit has been taken out of the cogs?
Oh, God, no. No.
What in God's name just happened there?
Yeah, that analogy went off the rails. I'm really sorry about that. You know, grit and the cogs, that story.
The rails went off the cogs with the grids?
All I know is that the cog piece will be with us. No, God, no. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't have anybody in his administration who is really actively working on liaising, if that's a word, with Congress to pass any kind of legislative agenda. I've got a wet towel on my head right now.
Republicans don't have. I mean, like, who is going to muscle things through? The you know, the limp noodle of Mitch
nobody.
Or, you know, or Paul Ryan. Yeah.
No. They absolutely deserve each other, and I place 97% of the blame on the debacle of Obamacare re-whatever on the Republican Congress. They didn't want to do anything. And so what has Trump been doing since then? He's been picking fights with Jeff Flake. He's been doing Trump-like things all over the place, picking fights with John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who deserves some fight picking, to be sure, on occasion. But so I don't see how there's going to be this warm embrace. There might be a on occasion cooperation. Shut up. Kind of cooperation of mutual interests on a temporary way. There's a term of art. You know what I'm talking about. But that won't last particularly. And I think that'll just happen in discrete areas of foreign policy on occasion. But even there, his style irritates people so much in the establishment that even if he goes in their direction, I don't think that they're going to like him in any way, shape, or form. So we're looking at, I mean, everyone on the conservative side was making fun of and criticizing, and I think for good reason, when Barack Obama in 2013 said, I still got a pen and a phone. We're going to look back at the Trump presidency. That's all he had from the beginning is a pen and the phone. And fortunately, I think for the country and for us and other things, some of that pen work and some of the organization that Nick was alluding to before in the administrative state has been great. And there are people there who are busy doing work that I think is going to be on the whole very positive and more groundbreaking than we've seen anyone do in a long time. However, as like a rapprochement between Trump and the establishment, I don't think it's ever going to happen. He's desperately unpopular and he's kind of a jackass, and Republicans are completely feckless and they will go in whatever direction.
Well, I think the one thing that you can hear is, or you can see everybody, the Republicans anyway, getting on board with is tax cuts. They have shown that they're not interested in actually cutting the size, scope, and spending of government, or at least the size and the spending of government based on Trump's budget, as well as kind of what the Republicans are talking about. You know, we're not seeing year-over-year decreases at the very least. But what we may see is a radical set of tax cuts that are, I'm guessing, are going to be unfocused and kind of incoherent, but everybody gets to rob the candy store at least once and take out their favorite sweet. And I think that's problematic because, again, I mean, like, you know, we're in like a Sitzkrieg situation here where, you know, we're the people on Dunkirk Beach that, you know, nobody knows quite what's going on. There seem to be these large forces that are shooting at us, whether it's globalization, whether it's automation, whether it is North Korea, rogue things like that. And we're just hanging out. And it's not clear that anybody has a big picture or even where we evacuate to. But I feel like, you know, the Republicans, the one thing we can count on them for is tax cuts. We can also count on them to fuck all of that up and either deliver the worst kind of tax cuts that just make the tax code even more confusing and more complicated, but speaks to their particular special interests or interest group politics. But that's the one thing I think you're going to see through the end of the year that Trump is actually hanging his hat on. And that will rouse Mitch McConnell from whatever mud bank he's sleeping in now, you know, to actually get out and maybe get 50 votes for something.
This what you just described there, Nick, was the verbal equivalent of a bad political cartoon.
No,
you were like,
yeah,
we're the ones on the beach and the missiles
tax
reform
writing,
or something.
I think my body right now, I'm writing disgruntled libertarians so that people will know in that cartoon who I am.
Yeah, that's right, because that should be just so that people know who you are. No, I mean, I think this is again part of Trump's perennial outsider thing, right? Like every jackass politician in the world runs as an outsider now, right? I'm not part of the Washington establishment. Vote for me because I'm an outsider. Even Hillary Clinton ran as an outsider. And, you know, luckily we just don't believe any of them, right? We understand that this is just a thing you say during the campaign and then it's over. But Trump seems to have sort of drunk his own Flavor-Aid, right? He is still acting like an outsider, even though he's the goddamn president now. And so it results in stuff like, hey, I wish someone could tell me what we're doing in Afghanistan. Or hey, these establishment Republicans, I'm going to use my Twitter feed to bring them to you. And you're like, you are the establishment Republican. You couldn't be more establishment. You're the president. I totally agree with Nick that he will, that if anything happens from the Republican Congress, it's going to be tax cuts. They are not going to come with tax reform. They are not going to come with spending cuts. And then later, when we are all in even more debt, people are going to say, look, it was the evil Republican tax cuts that did it.
The outsider element of American politics is one of my favorite things about politicians, that every single politician is convincing you they're not actually a politician.
Like, who's on the inside? Who's left in there?
Like no other job in America works like that, where you're like, whoa, I'm not an electrician. I'm not a career electrician. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just a guy that likes football, and everybody jumps on it. But yeah, I think you're right. Trump is maintaining that outsider status and will probably continue to blaze through it, if not dig himself in deeper, if through nothing else, by picking fights with the Republican Party, which he might be gearing up to do on Tuesday, because on Tuesday, Trump will be in Phoenix, Arizona, where he'll be holding a rally and will making some kind of announcement and is holding us in suspense. But there is some speculation that the announcement will be he's endorsing a primary challenger against Senator Jeff Flake, who has been one of the more outspoken critics of the Trump presidency on a variety of fronts, including, you know, his apparent affinity for strongman rulers. He recently published a book called The Conscience of a Conservative, which is a clear allusion to Barry Goldwater, and is likewise critical about many of the elements of the Trump administration. And Senator McCain as well, who's, I don't believe, going to be up for a primary for a while, but nonetheless is fighting with Trump through the health care bill, and who Trump is happy to continue lambasting. So we're going to very likely see some additional above board in-party infighting between Trump and Jeff Flake. I wanted to pour a little bit more grist on the cogs. I'm just pouring some grist on the cogs.
Also, though, like in-farty. That's what got me. Sorry. I'm like three.
Oh, good. So that wasn't me messing up so much in terms of my tortured analogies. It was just fart.
We're laughing at the word fart.
Well, so
but I think it gets at a deeper truth about the Republican Party.
Well, I think you're all right.
But there's a lot of gas being passed now.
Nick, a question that I have is, given that we for all functional purposes, we have a president who is only nominally a Republican. Like, I look at Mike Pence, and there's things I like and don't like, but he's a Republican. I understand that he's a Republican. Trump isn't really a traditional Republican. Does the term Republican really have meaning at this point, when we've got so many different ideological groups competing in the arena?
Yeah, I think the essential definition of Republican, which, you know, defines all the people who lay claim to that, it is essentially that you're anti-abortion. Absolutely, there are no members of Congress or the Senate who are Republican, who are pro-choice. You know, that's a big part of it. Increasingly, it is, you're also in favor of a strong military, whether or not you're necessarily in support of a lot of intervention. That's a different question, but you never hear Republicans, or very rarely, with the exception of people like Rand Paul and to some degree Jeff Flake, who has talked about problems with the military. What we're getting at here, though, is that, and this is at the core of Flake's critique of his own party, and that's what is really fascinating about the way that he has moved forward, and in the book Conscience of a Conservative, which is that the guy who came to D.C. as a congressman after running the Goldwater Institute in Arizona, which is a very libertarian free market. He worked abroad, to kind of get rid of boycotts and sanctions against countries that were not directly involved in apartheid government, things like that. But we're getting heat from that, or countries wouldn't trade with them even after they had started, or businesses after they had started trading again with South Africa. This is a guy who's a free market. To call him a moderate Republican would even, it's almost like a calumny, but like, this is a guy who said, we came to Washington to reduce the size, scope, and spending of government. When we had the opportunity, we did not do that, and we persisted in error, where we increased spending massively under Bush, we increased regulation massively under Bush, we went all over the place in the globe seeking enemies and not really accomplishing very much other than, stoking anger at America. His beef is with his own party, and it's pretty impressive, to be quite honest. And he had a piece recently, I think it was in the Washington Post, where he was talking about the immigrants, the low-skilled immigrants who worked on his family's ranch that he grew up with in Arizona. And this is a guy who is incredibly humane, who believes in open borders, who believes, you know, both for goods and services and for peaceful, law-abiding people who will come here and work. He was an architect of the Obama-era revision of Cuba policy, because he understood in a way that should be obvious to everybody that the embargo against Cuba was hurting Cuban people, not the Castros and not the apparatchiks and the Communist Party down there. If you're getting on the wrong side of Jeff Flake, there's something wrong with you if you actually believe in limited government and small government, I think. So it's illustrative that he is the person that Trump is going after. And it's not because Jeff Flake is not a conservative or a limited government guy. He disagrees with Donald Trump about the aspects of Donald Trump that are absolutely the worst, at least from a libertarian perspective.
So Matt can testify to my longstanding love of Jeff Flake. When Matt and I used to work in the same office, that was around the era that the Washington Post published the Jeff Flake went and randomly spent a week alone on a desert island to like find himself or something while he was a member of Congress and like had a family and is a grown up. And he was like, yeah, I'm just going to take a knife and a book of matches and spend a week alone on an island. And I was like, that's it. He's my favorite person who's ever existed.
Don't bury the lead, Catherine. No, he's got some pretty
shirtless pictures.
He's really looking past he's got like husking those coconuts.
Just very, very.
And he's, yeah.
Yeah, he's a good looking gentleman.
So I'm sensing a lot of Jeff Flake love from everybody here.
So much, which means it is 5 minutes until he does something so horrific that all of us have to like burn our Jeff Flake fan club card. I definitely don't have one of those.
Does he? I don't know. I know less about Jeff Flake than you guys do. Does he hang out at the same cool kids table that Justin Amash and Rand Paul are at? Is he a part of that sort of little L libertarian Republican? Does he identify that way?
Yes and no. I mean, he's not part of the Ron Paul vanguard, the new generation of Tea Party people. He's been at this for a while, as Nick was alluding to before.
Although the Goldwater Institute's a fairly overt libertarian organization, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I mean, he is libertarian. I'm just saying he doesn't have that kind of Thomas Massie bomb thrower type of vibe. He was
Liberty Caucus before Liberty Caucus was cool, man.
Yeah. If you talk to him, and I know it's going to sound weird and off-putting to people who hate all politicians, but he's a pretty decent fellow in general when we've interacted with him. And it makes it funny that Donald Trump tweeted out recently that Jeff Flake is toxic, like of all things that Flake is. And you can criticize him. Like in his new book, for instance, he talks about how he made a mistake when he voted against the original bailouts in the fall of 2008. And like, you know, a responsible person should have voted for those bailouts. I disagree with him about that and the kind of nod to respectability. And I don't think that he covered himself with pure distinction when he was asking questions, cross-examining some of Trump's cabinet members there. I think he left a lot of pretty good libertarian arguments on the table. But that said, he's a pretty decent guy in Arizona politics and just sort of known as being nice. Like he's up against a Democrat, I believe, who is a Muslim, who's running up against things. And he went out of his way to say, you know, there's no room in Arizona for people knocking her on her religion. He's that guy. So that's one of the reasons why he's intolerable to Trump. And let's keep in mind, there's a lot of people out there, including Lawrence O'Donnell had a piece on this 8-10 days ago. It's like, you know, Jeff Flake, where were you during the birther controversy? It turns out Jeff Flake was passing legislation aimed or resolutions aimed at kind of defanging that way back in 2009. He's that guy who hates the ugly underside of Republican politics and always has. He, during the 2016 campaign, was going around Washington urging his colleagues not to endorse Donald Trump in like June, July, and August. Like, even if he gets a nomination, we shouldn't endorse him. We should withhold it and try to extract anything good from him. So he's been a thorn in Trump's side, and Trump can't handle it. And so it's a very telltale thing. The other thing that Trump might do at this Arizona rally, which I'm, if I wasn't, you know, talking at the bottom of an iron lung right here, I might go out and look at because it's pretty interesting. He might drop a pardon for Joe Arpaio. in the middle of all that kind of stuff, which would be a really red meat kind of moment there in Arizona politics.
There's also this, you know, the element of Trump grudge holding. I mean, the fact that Flake was going around as a sort of a face of respectable Republican opposition to Trump, like Donald Trump's not going to forget that. This is something that's never going to go away. This is exactly the kind of, you know, vengeance politics that you can expect to see, that he would endorse a challenger. But Flake also, I mean, he was accused of doing stuff to be invited to these Beltway cocktail parties. Which is great because he doesn't drink because he's a Mormon. So he'd be like drinking the milkshake at the cocktail parties, I think Matt suggested. But also, you know, just the idea that I think to Trump's mind, he's clearly motivated by hatred of Trump when, in fact, he's very clearly motivated by ideology. And there are only a few people on the Hill who I could say are motivated by ideology that I think is a good ideology. I mean, there are plenty of people on the Hill motivated by their ideas and ideology, but it's a small, small group of guys up there who are doing something that looks like principled small government conservatism or libertarianism, and Flake is one of them.
Yeah, and you know, in a recent piece for Politico that ran when his book was being published, and I have the paragraph right here, but he says there are three things that Republicans need to do if they want to actually be a force in national, a force for good, meaning reduce government in national politics. And he says, you know, we shouldn't hesitate to speak out if the president plays to the base in ways that damage the Republican Party's ability to grow and speak to a larger audience. Second, we need to take the long view on issues like free trade, populist and protection policies might score, you know, quick wins, bad for the country. And third, he said that, you know, the Republicans need to stand up for institutions, you know, and prerogatives. And he mentioned by name the Senate filibuster, which worked to check power and slow things down. I don't know that I agree, excuse me, with all of those. And I certainly don't agree with every stance that Jeff Flake has taken over the years. But, you know, this is somebody who is actually serious about the work of governing. And he is centrist and moderate in his tone, which isn't to say that he is, you know, he's lacking that ideology that Catherine talks about. I mean, this is a very principled guy who also recognizes that politics is not the same as philosophy. And again, I mean, if he's the guy who is drawing ire, that's a sad statement about, you know, the president and who's running the Republican Party right now. Because if we had 20 or 30 or 40 Jeff Flakes, you know, in 10 or more, you know, kind of Rand Paul types, you know, we would have a government that was actually balancing its budget and spending within its means and not played all aspects of personal and commercial life, or, you know, fixing every problem in the world. We would be much better off. And there's, you know, it's really telling and negatively towards Trump that he has this hard on against Jeff Flake.
So Trump has a hard on against Jeff Flake. He also hates McCain. He's alienated the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, and he early on alienated the establishment of the Republican Party. Is there an actual bright line at which Trump and the Republican Party would cleave and separate, and they would openly call him out, Catherine? Is that something that's within the realm of possibility?
I wish there was some mechanism I could see, but there really isn't. I mean, the problem is D.C. is still basically red team, blue team, and I think he could personally insult every single sitting Republican in Congress.
He's almost there. He's doing a good job.
He's checking the list off as it is. He's like, you know, he's like Arya Stark, just like fucking Jeff Flake, John McCain. And they'd still say essentially like, yeah, but a Republican is better than, I mean, you know, this is something that I'm still hearing.
Do you think
hearing.
That's just kind of a go team tribalism?
Yeah, I think it is.
Or do you think they're just afraid that they're going to lose re-election if they go against a electrifying Republican?
I think those things are indistinguishable. I mean, the way that the entire system is set up, sitting congressmen are heavily, heavily incentivized not to piss off the president. The president is not incentivized to play particularly nice with Congress, particularly if he doesn't give a single shit about what legislation gets passed. And I think Trump has shown that, like, yeah, he'd like it if they could pass certain legislation, but he doesn't really care. It's all about, you know, who allocates the funds for reelection campaigns. So that's there. But more than anything, I do think it's just, yes, he's awful, but he's our awful. And people are still basically going to see him as on their side, no matter what he does.
Matt, you had spoken to Justin Amash in an interview recently where I think he said that the Republican Party needs to die, if I'm not taking that out of context. Do you think that Trump is going to have a big effect on the Republican Party long-term down the road? And do you think it's likely that the Libertarian wing is going to play a role in that?
He said the Republican and Democratic Party need to die. Excuse me, I'm going to cough a lot right now. Sorry about that. And I think that the Republican Party is going to come out of this. And you hear people like Flake talk about this directly. Amash talks about it directly, Rand Paul and others. That the Trumpism and Bannonism, whatever you want to call it, this sort of mercantilist, nationalist, sometimes ethnic kind of approach towards the world, which is wrong on a lot of policy, is also like radioactive hot fire
55.
To anyone under a certain age, 30, 35, 40, who knows. 55, yeah. Just snicking in, Nick, the both of us. They're salting the earth in theory, but it's this weird moment where the Republican Party is also doing on just numbers better than it has in a long time. And so given that, plus the perpetual cowardice of politicians and lack of kind of ideological or philosophical center and the way that they respond to market incentives, we're in this fluxy period which could break strongly in some direction right now. But it's amazing to me to watch Democrats mess this all up and say, well, see, that's why we've got to have $15 minimum wage everywhere, Medicare for all. The overall message.
Yeah. And on top of that, they're not even really going for pocketbook issues. And this has caused no small level of consternation among a lot of progressives and Democrats. Bob Kuttner, who got that interview with Bannon, at the American Prospect, where Bannon called ethno-nationalists and neo-Nazis losers and clowns, which is stunning given that he gave them literally and explicitly gave them a platform, he said, of the alt-right at Breitbart.com. But Kuttner, the reason why Bannon called him ostensibly was because Kuttner was like, Democrats have to stop talking about identity politics all the time and they have to actually start talking about economic issues. The problem with that, and Matt, I think you're absolutely right, is that, you know, when you're talking about two parties, the Republicans are like the Democrats now at this point, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, these are not people who are going to lead the Democrats into a bold promised land of electoral victory or economic sanity. I mean, they are talking constantly about, you know, when you look at the Democratic Party, the leadership is old and its ideas are even older. So it's like, let's just jack up the minimum wage. Let's have, restrictions on free trade. Let's regulate the, you know, in quote marks, if you're Elizabeth Warren or Hillary Clinton, you know, let's spend more money on everything. Let's tax the rich more. I mean, these are ideas that are genuinely unpopular and have already failed in American politics. And until the Democrats get their shit together, they're going to be sinking lower and lower, even if they can beat the Republican candidate in a, in the popular vote for the presidency going on three times in a row, plus, the first election the last election of the 20th century in 2000.
Can I ask, so the Democrats haven't mounted a full-throated and effective offense against Trump, which is surprising, but I'm not so sure that it's because they're specifically rallying around terrible ideas, but just because I think that it's a somewhat unwieldy coalition. Where I look at the map, and if you're a moderate right now, you're much more likely to be an independent or a Democrat than you are to be a Republican. And if you're a measured technocrat, you're likely to be a Democrat alongside somebody who's a fiery populist like Elizabeth Warren.
No, I mean, I actually think the point is that you're likely to be an independent. And you know, obviously, Matt and I wrote a book about this, which is now many years old, half a dozen years old in its first iteration, the Declaration of Independence. But the plurality of people in America are independents politically, and they're searching for something that is distinct from, you know, what you see in the Republican Party, where it's like you have a president who, you know, and the Trumpists can be like, oh, no, you know, he said he doesn't like neo-Nazis and stuff like that. But this is a puts up with a huge amount of kind of white pride in the most disturbing way possible, where there's virtually nobody left in this country who either is purebred white or gives a shit about that. We want diversity in every product that we buy, and we like diversity among the peoples of the world coming here for the most part. But you have a Republican Party that lies through its teeth about being a party of small government, and then is racially divisive, hates immigrants, has a lot of spleen vented towards the modern world in the 21st century. On the other hand, though, you have Democrats who are old. I mean, even though they managed to win in presidential elections, they win the youth vote. These are people who one strong gust of wind is going to reduce them to a pile of dust. I mean, you know, and they don't have any ideas. All of the action is with independents still. And it's the question of which of the major parties is going to seize the opportunity to be economic conservatives and social liberals more or less, not endorsing everything, but just getting the government out of a lot of stuff.
Nick, don't you think, though, that Heaton is right that one weird dynamic that happens over and over with the Democratic Party, and particularly has happened in the last election cycle, is that Democrats are simultaneously saying, we are the party of just being basically sensible human beings, and also we are a party with bold solutions for the future. And the sort of, I mean, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders really were the two avatars of those two chunks of the party. But what it winds up coming, they just lost this last time, but I think, you know, it's 50-50. The country is 50-50, and it has been for a long time. There is no Republican mandate. It was an electoral accident that we are dominated across the board. And to say what it winds up with them is with that, it winds up with them saying essentially, the only way to offer sensible Democratic solutions is to adopt this batshit progressive program. And they're sort of, that's their way of trying to squoosh the two things together. And it sits badly and doesn't work.
Well, all I'm saying is that the Democratic Party is at a low ebb for legislative power at the state level as well as at the national level. And I don't think it's a mistake. And under Barack Obama, whatever else people can say about him is, you know, he presided over a historic decline in the number of seats that the Democrats hold both at the national level as well as at the state level. And I don't think that's going to turn around, because the closer you get to elections that are, you know, at the local level, the less ideological people tend to be. And, you know, the real question, obviously for the Republican Party to modernize, and this is part of what Flake, how do you grow the number of Republicans? You're not going to do it by appeals to ethno-nationalism and kind of attacks on alternative lifestyles in a world where there are only alternative lifestyles, and you have to follow the economic prescriptions that you talk about. For the Democrats, they may have, you know, among younger people and, you know, millennials and whatnot, it's true that, you know, they are very off put by what they perceive as racism and kind of ethnocentrism and stuff like that. The Democrats can get by with them on that, but then the economic policies don't fly with anybody who, you know, has been working for more than a few years and recognizes that the Democratic Party is fundamentally anti-commercial innovation. I mean, you had Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, you know, attacking Uber and ride sharing programs, even as they took them to their campaign events. That doesn't sit well with the country at large. And obviously I would love to see the Libertarian Party emerge as a meaningful and vibrant alternative to these in an electoral sense, not just in a philosophical sense. I don't know that that happened, but that's the future. And we need to start promoting that, because when you talk to most people, you know, they like free trade, they like immigration, and the effects of immigrants on the country, they like economic innovation. And neither party can deliver that package of goods. And, you know, that's, I think, where we need to be.
I'll pivot to the other author of the Declaration of Independence for a moment. Matt, I think last week or the week before, Pew had one of its ongoing annual polls where they determined that the plurality of American voters are independents. I think it was 45 at the last count, 45%. So we apparently do view ourselves as independents. And that's certainly something that resonates with the people on the podcast. But when it comes to elections, people tend to shoot to either the Republican or the Democratic camp, and that legitimate independent middle evaporates pretty quickly. In the Trump era, is that likely to continue, or have we actually reached a watershed moment where independents are a legitimate phenomenon?
I don't know. Jesse Walker, our colleague, had a pretty good piece at LA Times I think yesterday, talking about kind of pushing back on the growing narrative that we're on the verge of some kind of civil war these days, where he pointed out that if anything, people are defecting away from those tribes like we were just talking about, but they're motivated by antipathy for the other. And that motivation can get you in the ballot box. It can dictate your behavior or influence it pretty greatly. And in a system that we have, which is a two-party system, it sort of naturally flows in that direction. It's going to take some kind of pretty big difference maker to change that dynamic. All of that said, we could be seeing one right now. I mean, this could be a realignment moment under Trump and the reaction to Trump thereof. And given the overall complete exhaustion, really, of on the Democratic side, as well as the nervous breakdown and an off-putting fecklessness on the Republican side, it would seem like things could start to rejigger. But I'm worried, and we've talked about this here before, that in times like this, when people are motivated by sort of a negative feeling towards the other, that you get this reach for people who have ever kind of more apocalyptic and authoritarian tendencies. I mean, the one incredible verbal tell to look at with Trump, with Steve Bannon, with Steve Miller, with a lot of these people who broadly share kind of a worldview, Sebastian Gorka, count how many times they say, yeah, fuck Sebastian Gorka. Count how many times they say, if we don't do fill in the blank X, we will not have a country. It's amazing. I mean, Trump said this from the beginning of his campaign. He has said this in the, you know, his leaked transcript of the conversation that he had with the Mexican president. Like, hey, look, you know, if we have bilateral trade deficit above $60 billion with Mexico, we're just not going to have a country. It's like, yeah, you know what? We're going to have a country. I've looked this up. I've seen how it goes. We would still have a country. But there's this sense of, and the left version of this is really like, you know, we have an oligarchy where the Koch brothers are putting the pollutions in my face. This lack of...
It's a terrible Bernie Sanders impression. You need to work on that.
It's actually usually good. But again, I'm talking at the bottom of a well right now.
So being weirdly having a cold inhibits your a Sanders impression. Normally, I would think having a cold would help.
Strangely true. So I don't see a lot of green shoots out there of people looking at this dynamic and going in a direction that looks promising in any way for my kind of sense of ideological presuppositions. The best thing is that more people are independent, more young people are independent, and all this kind of stuff, and there's more interest in third party and the Libertarian Party in particular. But that and, you know, 25 cents will get you something that costs 25 cents.
Hey, this is what the eclipse, I guarantee you right now, by, you know, in a couple hours, when the eclipse is finished, we're going to be living in a totally different America, a better America, an America that conforms to my dreams and desires. Finally, very excited about that.
My measure of the sort of awfulness of our politics is how frequently in a given day I hyphenate something with the word nationalism. So it's like ethno-nationalism, economic nationalism, national socialism. Like, there's just too much hyphenation with nationalism. And this is the exact same phenomenon as this. If we don't create a points-based immigration system, we won't even have a country anymore. Unfortunately, the talk of our country as a unit, and also somehow that unit has to be governed exclusively by my shitty beliefs. You know, I don't see that going away, unfortunately.
And the prospect of ethno-nationalism remains, if not in the overall ideological mainstream of America, at least in the discussion of what's happening in America, including Charlottesville, which continued creating waves last week, not just because of the terrible things that happened in Charlottesville, but because of President Trump's odd way of dealing with it. So you had the rally in Charlottesville, you had a neo-Nazi kill someone, and then Trump initially had a statement saying that he was against bigotry and intolerance, and was weirdly omitting the alt-right neo-Nazis and white supremacists. So he rectified that two or three days later, which was suspiciously late, and then had a press conference last week dealing with infrastructure, and decided to field questions on the fly, and seemed to get really angry and worked up, and appeared to more or less equivocate between whether or not the left and the right was bad or shared the blame in the Charlottesville situation, or to rephrase that, whether or not the sort of counter anti-neo-Nazi, anti-white supremacists were also violent and therefore bad people. And then he also said that there were good people on the side of the protesters. So he seems to be returning to coddling the alt-right after a very brief point where he was casting them aside. Am I reading that correct, Catherine? Is he coddling the alt-right, and is he going to create a wedge issue by doing that?
I don't even know anymore. I mean, yes, obviously something weird happened in that dynamic where he didn't immediately condemn the people who actually managed to kill someone with a car. At the same time, I think there's been a lot of weirdly off-target response to this, including the ACLU, who, facing dissent from some local chapters, including a couple in Northern California, backed away from their position on free speech a little bit last week by saying that they would no longer support people who wanted to rally while carrying firearms, which, again, similarly, sort of like totally off topic, right? Like, no one got killed with a gun. This was a car. So I think people are trying to figure out a way to position themselves around what happened in Charlottesville without sort of backing themselves into a corner. Trump was trying to avoid having to say out loud the words, "I don't like the alt-right." The ACLU is apparently now trying to avoid saying out loud the words, "We support free speech, even for Nazis with guns." And that's too bad, because we should really say those things out loud, both of them. Screw the alt-right, we support.
But by the same token, protests. I mean, Trump didn't actually have to say, "I dislike the alt-right in all of its permutations." He could have said, you know, very easily and very cleanly, free speech applies to everybody, even fucking neo-Nazis, who were walking around chanting, Jews
right.
will not
and
replace
And we hear
us,
at Reason said that.
And carrying swastika flags and chanting blood and soil. And there is, the Trump minions in the, on the internet and whatnot, online and in social media, were enforcing a politically correct line where if you said anything against neo-Nazis, it was, so you're like cocksucker for Hillary Clinton. I mean, these are the types of responses I got. I don't think it should be a stretch for the president of the United States to be anti-Nazi and also allow them to march under the banner of free speech. And that, I think, is what bothered people. And it wasn't just simply people on the left. I mean, a lot of people on the right have long been, accused of harboring Nazi sympathies and all of that kind of stuff. So they get really uptight about this. And I think they're right to. There's something fucked up about a president of the United States at any point in history who was not anti-Nazi. And can't muster enough to say that. And the only explanation for it, ultimately, I think, is that Trump recognizes that if he got, if he pissed off the neo-Nazis, he would actually be alienating part of his base, not just Nazis, but people who are like, "Oh, I love him because he's politically incorrect. He's the ultimate troll," which is a large percentage of the people who make up the alt-right. And to the extent that the alt-right is an ethno-nationalist movement, fuck them. I mean, it's creepy and disturbing and completely ahistorical if you want to be on the side of what's good and decent about American society. And I think Trump failed that. You can go on and on too long. And it's true that Antifa is, they're a bunch of scumbags, but they're not actually saying, "Oh, we love Elizabeth Warren and we love Nancy Pelosi," the way that David Duke specifically said after Trump's last press conference. It's like, "Thank you, Donald Trump, for endorsing us." I mean, they're fucking voting for him in a way that at least anarchists who are scumbags when they punch Nazis without an attack on them, when they do it in something other than self-defense. But they're not supporting the Democratic Party.
To go back a little bit further beyond Nazi ideology to racism in America and Confederate ideology. One of the things that Trump has gone off on Twitter the last week was getting rid of these beautiful Confederate monuments in our country. There's no difference between Robert E. Lee and George Washington. I think that's the parallel that he drew. Matt, do you think that we should be removing Confederate monuments?
I think you work back from what the federal government is doing and what local governments are doing, and you deal with it at each level like that. I don't understand why you would have a Confederate monument anywhere outside of a battlefield. And speaking of which, if you've ever been to us Yankees call Bull Run and what the Southerners called Manassas, the Stonewall Jackson there is on his horse. The horse has more muscles than peak Schwarzenegger. It is an astonishing kind of hagiography. It's crazy talk. I'm persuaded that by the argument that a whole lot of those statues went up during moments of high contemporary racial or civil rights stress, and it was a way for people to kind of reassert this bad dominant race-based ideology, and that we shouldn't lament that. I don't like people tearing down statues unless maybe it's the statue of Freddie Mercury in Vevey, Switzerland, just for fun, and take a picture of it. People go so quickly to the absurd extreme. Ed Kraevsky had a great piece at Reason talking about the misguided attempts to try to get rid of what is a private statue of Lenin, of Vladimir Ilyich, not John, in Seattle, which is sort of taken as kind of an ironic gesture there. So people immediately got to be very silly very quickly. But I just don't think that Confederate symbology belongs on state capitals, on official government places that are not specifically a battlefield, talking about, you know, the blood that got spilled right there.
Well, Matt, I think we can all agree about the Freddie Mercury statue in Switzerland going down, and probably about the Confederates as well. Thank you all for joining us again. I'm Smarter, as always. Thank you for listening at home, and join us again next week.